This is The Full Story. I'm Tom Kuser. 2 weeks ago on The Full Story, we began a conversation about affordable housing challenges in Connecticut, specifically what might be done in the cities. It's a very layered issue, so we're devoting today's program to talking about efforts to change zoning rules to control what can be built and where through state legislation. Some say those rules affect racial and economic segregation. Right now, there are a number of bills related to zoning making their way through the General Assembly. If they pass, they could impact the way local governments are allowed to manage the development of new affordable housing units. Our guide through the bills and the legislature is Jacqueline Rabe Thomas. She's the education, housing, and equity reporter for the Connecticut Mirror. That's ctmirror.org online. And she joins us via Zoom. Jacqueline, welcome to The Full Story.
Thanks for having me.
Certainly. I mentioned there are a number of bills. Two of them seem to be getting most of the attention. But how many zoning bills are there in the General Assembly right now?
Oh, gosh.
That many, huh?
Yeah, there's a bunch. Whether or not they have a chance, that's a whole different discussion.
There are two main bills, as I understand it, that are getting the lion's share of attention. One is in the Senate and one's in the House. Let's start with the bill in the House, HB 6611. One of its provisions would decentralize affordable housing. What's that mean, decentralizing affordable housing, and how would the bill make that happen?
Sure. So this bill is based off of the ability to sort of measure the need for affordable housing throughout the state. And it would do that through a study measuring just how many people are spending an incredible amount of their income on housing. You know, best efforts say that in order to not be so-called house poor, you shouldn't be spending more than 30% of your income coming in the door on housing. But unfortunately, so many people throughout the state are spending well over 50, 60, 70% on their housing costs. And so what this bill would do is sort of measure the need for more diversity in housing. And then once that number is derived from the need of housing in Connecticut, it would allocate to each region of the state how much housing is necessary so that there is housing diversity and there is a wider variety of housing affordability in each community. And so what the bill does is it outlines for each town and region, here's your responsibility for making sure there is some more affordable housing in the state for those teachers, those firefighters, but also daycare workers and other people who are just not able to find decently priced housing in certain communities.
So decentralizing essentially aiming to move it out of just a few cities in the state.
Right. So if you look historically at where affordable housing, where the state and federal government has spent money building and subsidizing affordable housing, it is concentrated almost entirely in the inner cities. And what that has an effect of doing is places like Hartford, where 40% of all its housing is deed restricted or specifically reserved for significantly low income individuals. That makes it really hard for places like Hartford or your New Havens or your Bridgeports to raise money for things like your schools. And so when your tax base, so many people are from lower income families, your tax base is not going to generate enough revenue to pay for all the services that a town needs to be able to afford things like schools, police, public safety, health, all the things that a lot of towns are able to provide in the suburbs.
And over in the state Senate, the bill number 1024 also getting a good deal of attention. Could you talk about what's in that bill? And as I understand it, what was taken out of that bill before it left one of the legislative committees?
Sure. So that bill is, before it was voted out of committee, I'd say one of the most controversial things in that bill would have allowed for unit duplexes or three unit or four unit housing units to be able to be built without having to go through a special process in each local municipality. And that's not to say that the public hearing process would be completely thrown out. What it is to say is that the public hearing process would not need to take place for every single application for a duplex in town or a triplex. And instead, what it would allow for is for those to be built so-called as of right without needing to go through a special public hearing. And what the towns would have to do is to create about a half mile within their local train station, their primary train station, or their downtown corridor to create zoning that allows for those types of units. So set the architectural designs, set the setback units, set the parking requirements for those, so that if someone comes in and meets all those parameters for a duplex or a triplex, they're allowed to be approved by the local permitting division, planning department in town without needing that special panel to consider everything that comes with it, allowing those to open on a project by project basis. And so that faced a lot of pushback. A lot of places around the country have done this already. It got taken out of the bill before it was voted out of committee, though, however.
You mentioned the other things that come along with objections to developments that are pushed aside based on these bills. One of the things I think both of them address is a concern about the character of a city or town. In the past, opponents to these kinds of developments have said they will negatively affect the character of their municipality. What does that mean, and what do these bills say about that? Do they reject this this ability to raise a concern about character?
So that's a very interesting question, and a lot to unpack there. So when you're talking about the so-called character of a town, right, that's very subjective. That's not something where you can say, okay, it's 50 feet setback from the curb. Okay, check that box. We got it, right? There's two parking spots that we require. Check that, right? We got it. But a character of a town, it's much more subjective. How do you define character? And so what one of the bills that has been approved in previous years with bipartisan support out of committee as well as out of the House, but has never made it out of the Senate into the governor's desk, would strip that ability to deny projects based on whether they fit within the so-called character of a town. You know, a lot of housing advocates see this as sort of a dog whistle of saying, does single family zoning fit within the character of your town? Because if you don't think single family zoning fits within the character, or sorry, multifamily housing fits within the character of your town, then there's a lot to unpack there, right? There are reasons why certain people are not able to afford a single family house. It's more expensive. So now we're talking about pricing certain people out of your community. And unfortunately, in America, we have a history that has allowed certain populations to accumulate wealth and others not to. So just right there, you're talking about who can access purchasing a single family home in certain communities. And so the character of a community in state law that has long existed, it's been targeted year after year by housing advocates to do away with that subjective terminology. Those on the other side of the aisle will remind you that Connecticut has a lot of character, small town feel, and that they feel that they should be able to have that sort of broad measure to be able to turn down projects that don't fit within their scope. And you can't define everything. So you can't define every single character of your town that you'd like to see in zoning. So it does kind of provide this sort of broader brush of what can and cannot be approved. And also there is a law, 830G, that does allow, when you're talking about trying to develop affordable housing for people who are lower income from significantly lower incomes, that there is a way to go around that so-called character of a town. That's not a reason to be able to deny people going around local zoning ordinances. And so there is sort of a loophole to get around the local character of a town requirement to get a project developed. It's long, it's burdensome, and few projects are actually able to cross the finish line through that process, however.
I'm talking with Jacqueline Rabe Thomas, the education, housing, and equity reporter for the Connecticut Mirror, online news Connecticut Mirror. And we're talking about the zoning legislation that's currently in the General Assembly in Connecticut. Jacqueline, this is not, of course, the first time the legislature has considered a change to zoning rules, right? This has a history.
Right. So, you know, how far back do you want me to go? So, you know, the big law that we have in place was adopted 30 years ago. It's called the 830G. I just mentioned it. And that law has been in place for a very long time that allows developers to go around local zoning ordinances in the name of building affordable housing. You know, you can look at town by town and how many projects have actually crossed the finish line. And I think it's something like 6,000 units have been developed in 30 years. So measure for yourself whether or not that's a success, 6,000 affordable units over the course of 30 years. If you talk to housing advocates, they say that's not nearly enough to meet demand. If you talk to people who have been in some of these communities where 830 projects have been proposed, they'll say it's uprooting local authority and locals know best of what projects should and should not be developed in town. So yes, there's a long history of affordable housing efforts in Connecticut. Connecticut, however, has not moved the ball very much over the course of those 30 years. I did a project in 2019 and I found that 24 towns have seen no net increase in affordable housing over 30 years. And so, you know, in those towns, there hasn't been an increase in the ability for people who would want to move from the urban centers to their communities. There hasn't been an effort to be more welcoming as far as different types of housing for people to get in those communities. I mean, it's not hard to look at different communities around the state and see that 99% of the land is zoned exclusively for single family homes, and the remainder of the land is zoned for their local business district. And so you can see that town after town, that there are certain communities that very much see themselves as single family hometowns. And it's showing up in things like Connecticut is one of the most segregated places in the country when you look at different data marks. So there's reasons why there's been efforts to try to overhaul local zoning bills in the legislature.
You've clearly covered the issue for a number of years. Is this year unusual in terms of the number of bills that have been proposed?
I wouldn't say in the pure volume of bills that have been proposed. I would say that this year is a bit unusual in that, for a couple of things. There's a new organization, Desegregate Connecticut, who's really raised the conversation on this. They're hosting public forums around the state. And so they've really sort of raised the temperature on this. There's also the murder of George Floyd also raised awareness of the impact that historical exclusionary zoning practices and redlining and the like have played on where people live and what opportunities they have. And I'd also say that the majority leader of the House has been one of his priority issues for years. This is his first year as the majority leader. So I think there's sort of that trio of things going on is sort of raising the possibility that this might be the year that something happens.
From your reporting, do you have a sense of whether or not these bills or any of these bills have enough momentum to pass? Is there any bipartisan support for any of them?
I mean, look, Democrats have controlled the Senate and House for 24 years. So they've controlled the General Assembly for two decades. A Democrat has controlled the governor's office for 12 years, 11 years now. And so, you know, if Democrats were going to act, they've had the opportunity for quite some time now. Democrats, I don't think are united on this necessarily. You know, not that they don't think that this is an important issue, just how to sort of tackle this issue has been an issue. You know, we're a suburban dominated legislature. And so there's, you know, suburban Democrats feel differently than urban Democrats. And then even within urban Democrats, they feel differently about what the priority should be. Should it be focusing on urban centers versus on zoning reform for the suburbs? And so there hasn't really been, I think, consensus reached at this point. So whether or not this will be the year, I think, remains to be determined. There are several lawsuits that could sort of force the legislature's hand to finally act, but I think those will take some time to work their way through the courts.
Jacqueline Rabe Thomas, thanks so much for your insights and perspective on this issue today. We appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Certainly. Jacqueline is the education, housing, and equity reporter for CT Mirror. That's ctmirror.org, also known as the Connecticut Mirror. Today, we're taking a closer look at how Connecticut's zoning laws affect the number of affordable and modest housing units in the state. Right now, there are two pieces of legislation before the General Assembly that could significantly change those zoning rules. One organization that's supporting change is Desegregate Connecticut. It's a coalition of nonprofit groups and individuals who say housing diversity needs to be expanded in Connecticut. And joining me now on the phone is Sarah Bronin. She's the founder and lead organizer of Desegregate Connecticut. She's also an attorney, an architect, and her husband happens to be the mayor of Hartford, Luke Bronin. Ms. Bronin, welcome to The Full Story.
Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, certainly. First of all, could you tell me a bit about the organization? How did it get started, and why did it get started?
So the Desegregate Connecticut Coalition formed last June, really in response to so much that we were seeing going around nationally, including the George Floyd murder, that exposed racial inequalities. So people from the professions, architects, planners, lawyers, municipal leaders and other planning commissioners and other experts really got together and said, what can we do about the area of government, the area of law that locks in inequality in perhaps one of the most basic ways, and that is through zoning and the way that zoning treats housing.
I'd like to put a definition on the table for listeners, too. When we say housing diversity, what do we mean by that?
What it means is different kinds of housing that are available to people to choose from. Right now in Connecticut, for example, we have done research through the Connecticut Zoning Atlas. It's available on our website that shows that single-family housing is allowed in 91% of land in Connecticut, whereas three or more family housing is only allowed as of right on 2.5% of Connecticut. So what we've done here is we've concentrated housing options, housing diversity, into just a few places, which means that we don't really have open communities for across the state. And it's really hurt us, not just from an equity perspective, but from an economic perspective, too. I call it one-size-fits-all zoning. That's what we have in Connecticut.
So how does that affect desegregate, or in this case, how does that affect segregation, the lack of types of zoning in so much of Connecticut's territory?
So you can start with the concept of how many units of housing are allowed on a lot. And, of course, if you allow more than one single-family home on the lot, it's a lot less expensive. It's a lot easier for people of different means and different backgrounds to get into a neighborhood that they wish to live in. But we also see that there are a lot of more technical and maybe hidden requirements of zoning codes, things like parking requirements, things like a minimum lot size, things like technical requirements on sewer issues that really all work together to slowly chip away at the availability and the possibility of new housing being built. If you look at Connecticut's housing numbers compared to the entire country over the last year, the U.S. Census just released numbers showing that Connecticut is dead last in housing production. Over the last year, as housing surged nationally by 17%, we have built 30% fewer units than last year. So, again, the numbers are pretty stark here. And by building fewer units, that also contributes to lack of affordability. It also contributes to lack of supply in different places. And that just locks people into the neighborhoods they're in and prevents mobility.
There are several bills, as I mentioned, in the General Assembly that could change how and where affordable housing is developed in Connecticut. Could you talk a bit about those and why it is that Desegregate Connecticut supports those changes.
Sure. So the major bill that we're supporting is called SB 1024, and you can, again, read more detail about it on our website. But for now, I'll just say that what it tries to do is tries to develop more clear guidelines for towns in adopting their own zoning regulations on a variety of measures. So, for example, it would legalize what's called accessory dwelling units, which are small units of housing that are on the same lot as a single-family house, let's say on the third floor or in a garage apartment. It would legalize those statewide. So what does that do? That allows homeowners to decide to create a small unit of housing, nestle it on the same lot where they live, and it also creates a new unit that would allow other people to join into a neighborhood, be more welcome in the neighborhood. We've seen statewide laws like this in California have increased accessory unit production by 11-fold in Los Angeles alone. So we know that that kind of provision, which is one of the major provisions remaining in the bill as it has been passed out of committee, could do a lot for Connecticut, probably more than we even realize.
Wasn't there a key provision of Senate Bill 1024 removed? A key provision was removed from that bill before it left committee?
Yes, it was. There was a part of the bill that would have focused on transit stations and basically train stations, and also focused on communities' main streets in our larger towns. And both of those provisions would have created anywhere between 2 and 4 units of housing around those areas. We actually did a poll of Connecticut residents, and people overwhelmingly supported more housing and more dense housing around train stations. If you think about it, it makes a lot of sense. But some people thought, well, this might be going too far for this session. We hope that there's a chance that it gets restored. But if not, we think the bill still does a lot in its current form.
I understand some housing advocates had some reservations about that, too. They thought that might give sort of a free pass to towns that didn't have or don't have train stations or transportation hubs like that, which would include many towns in Connecticut.
Yeah, well, that's where the Main Streets provision would come in. So that would have required towns to choose where to zone around a commercial corridor that they chose. So they would choose the corridor. They would have chosen where they would allow 2 to 4 family housing, but they would have had to allow 2 to 4 family housing on Main Streets. And this would be for towns of 7,500 people or more. We thought that would have been an excellent complement to what we were trying to do around train stations. Because if you look at it, it's not just one community that needs to help to unlock the restrictive zoning rules that constrain housing development. It's lots of communities all around the state. And together, if we have a statewide approach, we think we could really make a big difference.
I'm speaking with Sarah Bronin, the founder and lead organizer of Desegregate Connecticut, about zoning in Connecticut and how it affects affordable and modest housing units in the state. There is opposition to changing zoning rules from the capital, from Hartford, from state government. Opponents say that that should stay controlled locally within the cities and towns.
So Connecticut happens to be a state that follows a certain framework from state and local government decision making. And our state was built on this framework. And what it says is that the state legislature gives local governments specific authority, and local governments only have the authority that's given to them by the state legislature. Right now, we already have a framework where the state has said that local governments can zone and place limitations on the way local governments can do that. So what we're doing is well within the existing framework, and we think, in fact, improves on the existing framework because it gives local governments more specific guidance as to how they can meet goals that the state has already set for affordable housing.
There are some state standards already in place when it comes to affordable housing, and some town and city leaders defend their record. They say their municipalities have developed multifamily housing that designates a percentage of the units as affordable.
So there are certainly towns that have made excellent progress in recent years on developing some housing. And so our legislation is intended to support those efforts, because we all know that even if one town goes out and develops a few housing and allows for a few housing developments to occur, that's not going to be enough to address the more systemic issues that we see thwart housing development. The kinds of laws that you mentioned are really geared also toward large multifamily buildings. Our proposals start much smaller but wider. So they apply to all towns, but they go for things like accessory dwellings and 2-4 unit buildings. Nothing in our proposals would require this session anyway, these large buildings to be built. So while it's great that some towns are using the existing laws to be inspired to develop more housing, the scale and pace of that housing development is insufficient to meet the needs that we see across Connecticut when it comes to housing.
You mentioned earlier when we were speaking about the interactive zoning map of Connecticut that's on your website, an interesting tool. What is that intended to show? How does it work?
It's intended to show over every inch of Connecticut where housing can be built and what type of housing it could be. So if you look at the zoning atlas, and it's desegregatect.org/atlas, you can click on any number of characteristics. You could click on one family, two family, three family, or four family allowed as districts. You can see what the minimum lot size is. You can see where accessory dwelling units are allowed. And even within accessory dwelling units, what kinds of restrictions might be placed on them. For example, many communities do allow accessory dwelling units, but they prohibit anyone from living in them who isn't a family member or an employee. Of course, that will deter the creation of these types of units. And you can see that really clearly in the zoning atlas.
What impact did you want that to have? Did you want to give viewers just an idea of what the entire state looks like, was the intention more specific to each individual town?
Well, we do have, if you click on any specific town, you can see what percentage of land in each town is zoned for your chosen criteria. So you can play around with that at town level. But what we really wanted to do with the data was answer a question that we had been receiving when we started to meet in June, which is, well, you're saying that we need to change zoning, but what does zoning actually allow now? And we predicted that when we started the research that Connecticut would probably zone a lot of its land for single-family housing and not so much for multifamily housing. But the differences that we actually found are much starker and much more vast than even we predicted. So we think that now, at this point, the data underscores the need for reform. It shows the differences between communities, and we think it will support additional research across a variety of demographic consequences of our zoning laws. And so I think that's the next step for the zoning data.
Why do you think the issue of affordable housing is so contentious in Connecticut?
I actually don't think that it's that contentious. I think most people support the creation of more housing in our state. They support places where young people can live, where young families can locate, where older people can age in place. We've seen so much support for our efforts across all of our coalition members, 68 different organizations, across thousands of people that have attended our events and worked with us and written to their legislators. So we see, hopefully, what we think is a real change in Connecticut and a realization that we can't keep doing the things that we've been doing. So I really have a lot of faith that people, as they learn more about the impact of zoning and the kinds of proposals that we are actually making, that they will kind of release some of the fears that a small handful of people have been mongering, and that they will come around to say, you know, this is something that's not only good for equity, but it's good for Connecticut, it's good for the vibrancy of our state, and it's good for really us to have to us to make changes that we can really be proud of. And so I see that. I don't see I see a little opposition, but I think it's narrow, and in many cases it's not based in fact.
Well, I'm sure there'll be more debate to come on efforts to change Connecticut's zoning laws to accommodate more affordable and modest housing units in the state. Ms. Bronin, thanks so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Sarah Bronin is the founder and the lead organizer of Desegregate Connecticut. As we mentioned earlier, there is organized opposition to the zoning bills. The members of CT 169 Strong have been working to get their concerns on the proposed changes to the zoning bills heard. Joining me now via Skype is Connecticut resident and CT 169 Strong member Alexis Harrison. Ms. Harrison, welcome to The Full Story.
Great, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Certainly. I know your group has held rallies in several Connecticut towns recently, but for those who are not familiar with the group, can you please tell us about it? First of all, where does the name come from?
Sure. So 169, there are 169 towns, cities, and rural areas of Connecticut. And our aim is to celebrate the diversity of our 169 towns and cities throughout Connecticut. And we're advocating for individual rights and local oversight.
And when were you organized? How long have you been in existence as the group?
We started organizing back in December when we realized a lot of these zoning bills would be on the table in the coming General Assembly.
And who are the members of the group? How many are there?
Sure, there are hundreds of members throughout Connecticut. We have members of various TPZs. We have, you know, residents like me who are just really concerned about land and the environment. It really runs a gamut.
So there are individuals as well as officials from towns and cities. So it's not just a town as a member. It's individuals.
It's individuals, correct. Right.
And from the perspective of your group, what should affordable housing be?
Well, I don't know if these bills actually create more affordable housing. And I think that is one of the biggest issues that we have with them. Mm-hmm. There is this notion that these will create affordable housing, more diverse housing. And we view them as really creating just more dense housing in the suburbs. We don't really believe they actually address the nuanced solutions that we need to create more affordable housing in the state. So that's one of our main issues. And we also have to remember, we do have an affordable housing law in Connecticut, which is called 830G, and that's been in effect for about 30 years or so. Many towns like my own town of Fairfield, we do a really good job of creating affordability in diverse housing.
More specifically, the bills, and I know there are a number of bills before the state legislature. A couple of them seem to be garnering the most attention. One that's being considered by committees was revised before moving on. A provision of the Senate Bill 1024 required communities to approve certain multifamily housing developments near train stations. And I believe that segment of the bill was removed when some local officials said that, you know, that would usurp their local authority. With that removal, do you think you are getting some response from lawmakers when you're asking for changes in the bills?
Yeah, and that was a really comforting thing, was to have that, you know, really bad policy removed from SB 1024. But as you know, probably from your research, you know, Desegregate Connecticut is working in earnest to get it back in. So there is, you know, it's not completely gone yet, and that is a major concern. SB 1024 at a high level really loosens standard building guidelines by increasing capacity for builders to use, you know, alternative sewage systems. We view it as a great gold rush for developers. Again, I don't know how that helps affordability in Connecticut.
Do the towns represented by the members in your group, you mentioned Fairfield, your town. Do you think you have adequate affordable housing available right now?
Yes, and we've been working towards that for many years here in Fairfield. In fact, our lay TPZ commission just passed a regulation that would expand accessory dwelling units back in the summer. We have, you know, transit-oriented developments by our train stations. I think we could always do better, but we've, you know, you have to leave this up to the local, you know, municipalities who do really hard work and have good faith efforts of creating diversity in our housing stock.
Who do you think should benefit from affordable housing, regardless of the type that it might be, whether it's denser or perhaps more spread out? Who should benefit from it? Is it the folks who already live in town, perhaps can't afford the prices because they're new to the market, or perhaps they're retired and they're older? Should it be folks from outside the towns? Who should benefit from affordable housing, do you think, in any individual town?
I mean, affordable housing is needed based on income. So I think anybody who has, you know, who has a lower income and who want to live in a certain town, they should be able to do so. And I think that's the benefit of affordable housing. That's, you know, one of the benefits, I think, of 830G is to really create affordable housing for people who just don't have the income. I just worry that the bills, such as one that you stated, 1024, doesn't really address affordability. You know, you can build, you know, a quadplex at the train station, rent them at high market value, or excuse me, fair market value, and I don't know how that helps people who are disadvantaged. Again, that's great for the person who already owns the land, but I don't think that really helps someone who doesn't have that generational wealth, or nor does it even create generational wealth. I think we should be really empowering home ownership. I think we should be, you know, helping the cities who are in desperate need of our help. If we siphon the populations from the cities and we, you know, encourage folks to move to the suburbs, I don't know what that's going to do to our cities like New Haven, like Hartford, who are really have significant issues. You know, real solutions, you know, really comes from all stakeholders. And that, my view of this process in Hartford with these zoning bills, not all the stakeholders have been at the table. Housing advocates have been at the table. Developers have been at the table. And that's really not coming up with a really nuanced solution for a very complicated issue in Connecticut.
Perhaps we should let folks know what 830G actually is. That's the affordable housing statute that's already in place.
Sure. 830G was created in 1990 after actually a year-long commission who researched affordable housing in Connecticut. And actually it lets developers really, you know, not have to abide by a lot of, you know, regular zoning laws or regulations in a town that a normal developer would. So it really, you know, eases that way into a town for a developer with the idea of creating, of making it easier to create affordable housing. You know, the ideas are, again, are lofty, and it's good. It creates, you know, affordable housing when a town doesn't have, you know, the proper number of units. You know, some towns don't. Some towns can't do it. And the theory is that 830G is going to, you know, solve that issue.
What does your group think would happen to the towns that are represented by your members if any of these bills are passed and the governor signs them?
I mean, I think a lot of the towns would bear a lot of financial burden when it comes to these laws. I mean, let's talk about HB 6611. That mandates a fair share of affordable housing units in all but seven cities. So most towns would need to double all their existing housing stock if they used inclusionary zoning to build those mandated units. But if those towns don't meet that fair share, and many can't based on, you know, infrastructure constraints for a variety of reasons, they will face lawsuits, as anyone would be able to provide legal standing. That includes, you know, academics, that's housing advocates. Anyone could actually intervene and really try to punish the towns for a lack of development. So that's one thing that's really important to talk about.
On your website, it says that the one of the real culprits behind the affordable housing crisis is a lack of good employment opportunities in Connecticut and poor economic and business public policy. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we believe in real solutions. We, you know, obviously affordability is a big issue in Connecticut, but it has nothing to do with zoning. And it affects all corners of our state. You know, you know, we don't have, you know, vibrant cities. We don't have jobs. I mean, as you see, as we all see, businesses are quickly leaving Connecticut. And we really need to come up with solutions rather than pitting, you know, the cities against the suburbs. The reality is these bills just don't create affordable housing. We need nuanced solutions, and we can't just do it in a matter of months. This will take, you know, several years. And I question why the legislature is really pushing these zoning bills so, you know, for so quickly and at a rapid speed. We need people to weigh in. We need all stakeholders at the table. And that's how you come up with good solutions. I'm not a legislator. I'm just, you know, an average citizen. But I think we all know nothing good when it comes out of rushing something.
Among the goals of those who support the zoning bills in the General Assembly are housing equity and desegregation in Connecticut. Do you think an improved business and economic opportunity situation would address those concerns?
Yeah, you know, we have, you know, people are leaving Connecticut. They're not coming to Connecticut. There's really not a lot of reason to come to Connecticut. We don't have the jobs. We're just not offering, you know, the amenities, the life, the culture that, you know, people, you know, want, especially the young people. So I do think we need to really focus on creating, you know, centers of commerce and business and make sure people want to come here. I lived actually in Seattle for a few years, and that was a booming city. I mean, young people were going there because there was business. There was, you know, great companies to work for. We really lack that in Connecticut, and that's really, you know, forcing people to move out. And we're not really, we're, you know, just having this constant brain drain that seems to happen all, you know, over and over again in Connecticut. So again, we just need our legislators, our lawmakers, and other people just to come to the table together to come up with solutions where we retain talent and the younger people.
You had mentioned that it seems that lawmakers are pushing these pieces of legislation through rather quickly. Why do you think they're doing that?
Well, it's not just that they're putting it through rather quickly without conversations with everybody. They're also really not articulating these fundamental changes to our zoning laws to their constituents. I know my own state rep, who is the chairperson of the Planning and Development Committee, she has not had one conversation to her constituents about these major changes happening. And we also have to remember this General Assembly session is taking place over Zoom. People are not even meeting in person. And I really think it's, you know, I think democracy dies in the dark, and I think we should hold off on these bills until everybody can talk about them. And if people are focused on getting their vaccine, getting their kids back in school and returning to life after a year-long pandemic, and our legislators are just pushing something really quickly without the input of the people, and I think that's a real disservice. I don't have an answer on why, but I think that's bad policy.
Ms. Harrison, thank you so much for spending time with us and sharing your perspective on this issue. We appreciate it.
Great. Thank you.
Alexis Harrison is a member of CT 169 Strong. The struggle between creating affordable housing and maintaining home rule in Connecticut is nothing new. It's got a long history. And so does the concept of zoning in general. We've asked Dr. Gary Rose, chair of the Department of Government, Politics, and Global Studies at Sacred Heart University in Connecticut, to join us. Professor Rose, welcome back to The Full Story.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
And Professor David Schleicher from Yale Law School. Professor Schleicher, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And I'll mention that we're getting together on Zoom here today. Well, we've been talking during this program so far today about zoning practices going back up about 40 years. But Professor Rose, the zoning or zoning in Connecticut is really much older than that, right? What are its origins?
Oh, zoning is something that really has been integral to, you know, the existence of local communities, really, from the time that our local towns, we have 169 of them now, but, you know, from the time that these local communities of ours started to develop and then proliferated, zoning has always been a very important factor in the existence of a town. In many ways, you know, what a zoning commission does, or a planning and zoning commission, sometimes there are two commissions, in many ways, I think, defines the character of a town, defines the culture of the town, and even defines in many ways the values of the individuals who live within those communities. And so zoning is really something that is very protected in Connecticut. You know, we have a long tradition of strong local towns. And so when I know that the zoning laws are being challenged now, I know that I believe it's actually coming out of Yale Law School, if I'm correct on that. And I think there is obviously, in fact, I know there is a major issue unfolding in Woodbridge, which is near New Haven. But we're really, in some respects, challenging, if you will, the sovereignty of towns here.
I mean, zoning as it's modern practice begins roughly in 1916. New York City has the first true zoning code in America. There's some building codes and things that pre-exist that, but use zoning, which is the kind of way we think, which the areas, cities divided into zones of residential, commercial, and what have you, really dates back just over 100 years. And so it doesn't go back to hundreds and hundreds of years to Connecticut's history. That's just not true.
So prior to early 20th century, were there ways of keeping, let's say, businesses and residential areas apart, industry away from homes, or was that even an issue prior to those early?
There were some limited methods, but they were not at all like modern zoning. Modern zoning really emerges after New York City passes the first zoning code, and then Secretary of Commerce Herbert Hoover promotes something called the Standard Zoning Enabling Act, which is a kind of a model law for states to adopt, and it gets adopted all around the country in the 1920s. It gets blessed by the Supreme Court in that period. And so there were nuisance laws, there were other things that limited the use of property, but the idea of a local government separating uses in the way that they do have done since then it was not true going back. And is, I tell you the truth, that the particular form of zoning that we use in America, particularly the strong protection of residential zones, is really a uniquely American phenomenon. There are land use limitations everywhere, height limits, density limits, and what have you. But the strict separation of uses, of keeping like retail stores out of residential areas, is a particularly American phenomenon. And to tell you the truth, Connecticut is one of the strictest states, and has been for a long time along those scores. So it is not one of those things that goes back to the founding. And you can see this in places that were developed pre-zoning, that you see much more integration of retail and residential. You see factories that are much closer to residential areas. You look at a city like New Haven, it's much more, it was developed pre-zoning, and we see much more integration of uses.
You know, if I could just add something, though, it is true that the zoning commissions themselves, with which Professor Schlecker is referring to, are somewhat, of a recent phenomenon, perhaps, as you said, 100 years ago, but coming out of New York. But even before that, though, I would suggest that maybe we didn't have formal, planning and zoning commissions, but the way that homes were developed and the way that land was apportioned was still very important to local communities. So while I would agree with him that, yes, it's true, the real formality of zoning is 100 years old, it really does go back farther, because people were very protective of their land and very concerned. Even though we may not have had these formal commissions that we have now, it is nevertheless a something that is really very much a part of local community traditions in the state of Connecticut.
Yeah, so I think that that's all wrong also, to tell you the truth. So earlier, Professor Rose referred to the sovereignty of local towns, but local towns don't have sovereignty in any meaningful sense. Cities or towns are products of state law. This is something the Supreme Court of the United States has made clear, and is also the content of the Connecticut Constitution. And so state can regulate cities however it wants. There's a cultural attachment to local control, for sure. There's a political belief in it, but it is not a legal rule of any sort. And so towns have always had concerns about interlocal externalities, the way one property affects others. There've been all sorts of plans of all sorts, New Haven's nine squares is a plan of sorts. I don't know how much turns on bringing it back 300 years rather than 100 years. It's a longstanding practice. But the effort to associate this with the 1700s is a little ridiculous.
Well, one thing on the sovereignty, it is true that towns are subdivisions of states, but yet I would also point out that Connecticut has, in the state constitution of 1965, a home rule provision, which does give towns a substantial amount of power and authority to control how they live. And so to suggest that they are just subdivisions of the state, I legally, perhaps you're correct on that, but at the same time, that whole rule, that home rule provision was given in the state constitution for the purpose of towns to manage themselves. And so to say that they are just under the control of Hartford, I don't think is really completely accurate, perhaps in a very broad legal sense, but yet at the same time, towns can create their own forms of government. They can create a town council system, a mayoral system, a selectman system, or whatever. And they can create, of course, their own zoning commissions. And so to say that they are just completely, some type of under the strings of Hartford, that's perhaps in a legal sense. I know you're correct on that. But at the same time, I think you're overlooking that the fact that towns have a lot of autonomy in Connecticut. They really have for many years, and it does go back, again, it goes back centuries, but it has been formalized in the state constitution in the home rule provision.
The home rule provision does not protect, while it does protect certain things, it certainly does not protect local regulatory authority of this type. Culturally it's protected. It's politically protected. Towns like it very much, and politicians who represent towns may like it. But it's just not so that while they can organize themselves as they see fit in certain respects, that the state couldn't overrule them or in fact revoke their zoning authority if it so chose. So I mean, it's not going to, but they could. And so the enveloping zoning and land use control in the kind of like bringing it back to the found, all this stuff is just like, it doesn't address anything particularly relevant about our current debates about zoning. And so only reason I push back here is to note that this is like an effort to undergird local control with some kind of historical power roots of Connecticut stuff that doesn't make too much sense.
You've, Professor Schleicher, you've mentioned this before. You've done a good deal of research regarding the concept of single family residential zoning, and mentioning that it's uniquely American, and that kind of zoning is certainly something that's it's top of mind as we look at the debate today. Between groups that claim zoning is really keeping certain groups of people out of towns, and those who say, no, this is us just trying to protect what we know we want our town to be. How is it that single-family residential zoning became an American obsession?
So, again, from the first zoning codes, that the protection of single-family residence zones and the single that only allow single-family residence and not any other uses was a particular part of zoning codes. And this is true across the country, although it's particularly true in Connecticut. Connecticut has probably the most restrictive single-family zones in the country, it or Massachusetts, but probably Connecticut. And the reasons for this are multiple. But I'd say people would put a couple of things as the justifications, or one is the exclusion of uses people didn't want factories near them, totally reasonably. Another and probably more dominant is fiscal zoning, is the desire to ensure that the average value of property stays high so that taxes can stay low. In a state like Connecticut, where local governments are more reliant on property taxes than any other state in the union, the desire to keep poor people out has been because it would increase the costs of providing schooling, is always been extremely a strong driver of restriction. And the third is not just keeping poor people out, but keeping minorities out. And this is it varies by place, but there's always been a deep relation between exclusion and zoning from the very beginning. So the Supreme Court, in a case called Buchanan versus Worley in 1917, right as use zoning is starting to happen, says that racially restrictive zoning, that is to say laws that say white people here and black people there, is unconstitutional. And that drives a huge amount of the desire to use zoning, that is to say, and density zoning, they'd say the limits on what types of housing can be as a proxy for doing this. And again, it's economic, it's racial, and it's also desire to keep unwanted land uses out, like factories or stores. And so it's a melange of different forces that are driving this, and different places will be different in what's most important. But the thing that is particular about American zoning is, again, the protection of this single family zoned with usually on very large lots. So Connecticut, you'll see things, extremely large lot requirements. So Greenwich has 4-acre lots, for instance, for large portions of the town, minimum. You could have more, of course, but that's the minimum. And this is a peculiar American obsession.
If we go back, let's say, to that 100-plus-year era, what led to the more formalization of zoning commissions and that approach to controlling land use, as opposed to the less formal way of controlling what was built where and when prior to that period?
So Herbert Hoover, so at New York City, creates what's basically a modern zoning code and commission in 1916. There's a variety of forces driving this. Skyscrapers that didn't have setbacks, immigrant stores and garment factories locating near fancy stores. So this was like the Macy's and B. Altman's of the world not wanting the rag trade to get nearby, and desires for segregation all drove, I mean, in a mixed sort of way, this. And then Hoover, as Secretary of Commerce, proposes this model law that gets copied everywhere. And so Connecticut's law is barely different from, I mean, there've been some new additions and things over the years, but it's barely different in like kind of broad strokes from what Herbert Hoover proposed in the 1920s.
So there are a number of changes being proposed in the General Assembly to zoning rules that could affect all 169 cities and towns across the state. Is this something unusual, Dr. Rose? Is this effort to make changes just another session in the Connecticut General Assembly? Or is there something, do you think, driving up the number of attempts to make a change?
Well, you know, there was a state Supreme Court ruling, I believe it came out of East Hampton, that actually had ruled as exclusionary zoning to be in violation of the Constitution. But nothing was really implemented following that ruling. And it is true that the Connecticut Mirror not long ago did an investigation into exclusionary zoning in Connecticut and exposed a number of towns doing that. But nevertheless, to your question, Tom, about the state legislature, well, what it really reflects is what has been happening in the state of Connecticut generally. The political climate within Connecticut has become increasingly progressive. And it is true, even though there are factions within both parties, the progressive wing of the Democratic Party is certainly has a very loud voice, you know, at the state capitol these days, and is promoting, obviously, some of the developments pertaining to zoning that Professor Schlechter has been referring to. And so I would say that it is it's a reflection of really what the Democratic control, which is now really in, you know, has a full firm grasp on Connecticut politics, both chambers of the state legislature, the governor and so forth, even registration, voter registration now, it's really out of line with respect to Democrats and Republicans. And what we are seeing here is, I think, a political really development that, and it's not just here in Connecticut, it's actually, you hear it happening down in Washington, D.C. too. They want to get the federal government more involved in zoning. It's strictly a partisan political development. And I would say that's what explains this tremendous emphasis that's going on right now in the country and here in Connecticut. That's the best way that I can explain it.
But
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I think the focus on the partisan nature of it is probably maybe overstated. That you've seen in state capitals around the country efforts at zoning reform. Some have been more successful than others, but along the West Coast, California, Oregon, Washington, and in the East Coast, Massachusetts has done some. You're seeing some movement in Virginia. California. And you've seen at the national level, both Republicans and Democrats supporting zoning reform. You see Republican senators Young from Indiana and kind of vaguely libertarian sort supporting zoning reform, as well as progressive Democrats. The thing they've run into is that opposition in towns among both Democrats and Republicans is extremely staunch. And so homeowners in Greenwich or wherever, or Darien or Woodbridge or whatever, may be Democrats. They increasingly are, but they're not pro-zoning reform for the most part. And so while Connecticut has largely been a laggard in attempting to reform zoning at the statewide level, having many reforms, well behind many other states, it is not exactly a one party thing, at least if you look at kind of these fights at the national level.
Even at the Connecticut level, what I was going to say, even though the Democrats have an upper hand right now, at least in political terms in Hartford, even though that's the case, the political waves have flowed back and forth over the years, sometimes Republicans in control, sometimes Democrats in control, yet the zoning situation has not changed markedly over that time period. Reflecting perhaps, Dr. Schleicher, what you had said, that it doesn't really matter if you're talking about a town with home rule and zoning issues that keep big lots and big houses, regardless of the party in control, that's not going to change.
Yeah, so the thing I'd say is that not only is it not going to, Connecticut has probably the strictest zoning in the country. Just so you have that, my colleague Bob Ellickson has did a really nice study that showed that the use, kind of the average use of minimum lot zoning, that are large lot requirements, limitations on multifamily zoning in Connecticut, and this is not even Fairfield. This is, he's doing a study of the suburbs of New Haven, is stricter than it is in Silicon Valley, which is often thought of as the cradle of American housing, the cradle of the American housing crisis. And so Connecticut is extreme. Connecticut towns are extreme in their limitations on building, and it's had a really deleterious effect on growth rates in the state. So it is, these are government regulations stopping private business and private entities for people from using their property to build things. And so while you could focus on equity concerns, it's also had a really big effect on the Connecticut economy. And I'd have to say that I think that one of the things driving zoning reform is not just the kind of concerns about equity, which I think are real and are strong, but also the kind of long run decline of the state as an economic force. Connecticut is shrinking relative to the country. It has extraordinary legacy costs in its pensions. And the only way to solve those problems is to grow. But Connecticut's growth has been choked by towns limiting growth through in building.
Dr. Rose, thoughts about that?
Yeah, well, you know, that's an interesting view that it is related to, the economic condition of Connecticut. But it seems to me that everything that I have heard about zoning reform is, in fact, very partisan. And while the professor has mentioned perhaps there are some states where Republicans and Democrats are agreeing on these issues, in Connecticut, from what I can tell, it really is coming out of a very liberal progressive caucus up at the state capitol. And it seems to me that this is much more about social concerns and racial equity, if you will, racial equality. And I would take issue with his position that it also is a reflection of economic concerns, because it really does seem to have so many racial dimensions to this reform. So it seems to me that it's really more social politics that's driving this issue more than concerns about pension obligations and so forth. So I would disagree with the professor on that point.
Well, the use of zoning, certainly a controversial issue. A question for both of you. Dr. Rose, do you see then local zoning rules really changing at all, despite what's going on right now?
Well, you know, given the involvement of the federal government in this issue now, the growing involvement, and from what I understand at the state up at the state level, and again the development of really progressive politics here in Connecticut, and I'll speak directly to that. And then what's happening in Woodbridge, I know that that's a big issue going on right there. And so that might be, I guess that is, in fact, the piece just came out a little while ago that said that's really the major test case. And so it seems to me that, you know, there could very well be some important developments in this area, motivated largely by politics, and then that will be blended with more of, you know, legal rulings as well. But it seems to me that that the control that towns have over zoning is something that could be possibly compromised in the days ahead. So that's how I see this.
Professor Schleicher?
So there have been two broad efforts, one in the state legislature that I think you've referred to a few times pass some reforms on local zoning, both allowing for the building of accessory dwelling units and putting some requirements on towns to allow some dense development near train stations, slightly, four unit buildings, that kind of thing, 4 to 6 unit buildings, that kind of thing, near train stations or near downtowns. That's having some difficulty in the legislature. The bill recently basically removed a lot of the requirements for dense apartment buildings, small apartment buildings near main streets, only a few other parts of it are left. And we'll see what happens. And then, as Professor Rose mentioned, there's litigation going on in Woodbridge. There's both a kind of application to the town and the potential for litigation that would set up a potential Supreme Court challenge to the Supreme Court under the Connecticut Constitution and really under the State Zoning Enabling Act, a little more accurately, to say that towns, excessively restrictive towns may be violating the grant of authority the state gives to towns to zone if they behave in too exclusionary a fashion. And so both of those things are going on. We'll see what happens in Woodbridge, and we'll see if there's a court case that follows it. It's possible that will happen. I think it's a very interesting development. What happened to the legislature, again, is there have been efforts over the years to pass some reforms to local zoning authority, particularly around the issue of transit-oriented development along the train lines, along the Metro North. So far, it hasn't happened. The deep conservatism of Connecticut, and I don't mean like kind of Republican, but I mean conservatism in like not changing the land of steady habits type stuff and protection for local towns, is extremely deeply ingrained. And so it is an uphill battle to change that. And again, Connecticut is the most of all states in the union, again, possible exception of Massachusetts, has the most restrictive rules on building. So any reforms are only may move it to 49th, but that's about what we'd say. You can report on what's going to happen in Hartford. But there are efforts to make reforms.
Professor David Schleicher from Yale Law School, Professor, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Dr. Gary Rose, Chair of the Department of Government Politics and Global Studies at Sacred Heart University. Dr. Rose, thank you for your insights as well today. We appreciate it.
Okay, sure, Tom. Glad to be here.
How about you? Have you dealt with zoning issues? Tell us about that. You can email us at tfs@wshu.org or go to Twitter. We're at fullstorywshu.org. And that's our program for today, produced by Fatou Sangare and senior producer Ann Lopez. I'm Tom Kuser. Thank you for listening to The Full Story.